Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project, where we look at two movies from the filmography of A24 every 2 weeks. However, in between those episodes, we try our best to bring you some interviews with the creative talent involved in bringing such exciting and diverse A24 films to the big screen. This week, we're joined by the writer and director of The Ballad of Lefty Brown, Jared Moshe. When cowboy Lefty Brown, played by Bill Pullman, witnesses the murder of his longtime partner, the newly elected Senator Edward Johnson, he strikes out to find the killers and avenge his friend's cold-blooded murder. Tracking the outlaws across the vast and desolate Montana plains, Lefty stumbles across a young wannabe gunslinger, Jeremiah, and an old friend, a former hard-drinking pal turned U.S. Marshal, to help deliver the men to justice. After a gunfight with the outlaws leaves Jeremiah wounded, Lefty returns home with the name of Johnson's killers, only to find that he's being accused of his friend's murder by the governor. With the tables turned, Lefty must evade the law, get the marshal to stop drinking again, and prove his innocence by exposing the powerful men ultimately responsible for Johnson's death. In this interview, I speak with Jared about his early career and inspirations, making his break into the industry as a producer before becoming a writer and director of feature films, what it was like to work with A24, and how it felt when they had reached out to him to distribute his film, his involvement with them as a company and their marketing machine, and what's to come in the future. Hope you'll enjoy this interview, and thanks to Jared for giving up his time to talk with us. We'll be back next week to discuss two of A24's most critically acclaimed films, American Honey and Moonlight, and I hope you'll join us then. Thanks for listening. I'm always interested in how a sort of a passion for film becomes a potential career opportunity for young individuals. What was it that made you or inspired you to work towards a career as a filmmaker?
I always had been interested in being in film. To me, I was a movie buff growing up. We started the first film club in high school. It was called Film. Frankly, I Like Movies, the acronym. And we would show movies during every morning, and we would, during like free periods when we came. I remember we got a snow day and I went into New York City to go see Fargo in like the middle of a snowstorm. It was a huge passion for me, but I didn't really understand anything about the industry, and I didn't really, I didn't go to film school. I went to like a liberal arts school in Massachusetts. So my path to becoming a filmmaker was sort of strange in that, like, I started interning at production companies and ended up, on the business side of things, as a sales agent, actually helping put together financing for independent films, raising money for independent films, selling independent films. At first it was just a job, but that became a background for me to understand how the industry works. So then when I felt like I knew enough to do my own creative, to make my own films, I had that background, which was very helpful.
What were the sort of films that were that big influence on you sort of in your younger years that you touched on things like Fargo and your film club? What were the films that you were always picking out and bringing to show your friends and fellow film buffs?
Oh my God, Westerns. I loved Westerns. They were my jam. I loved, I'd make them watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. The old John Wayne stuff, The Searchers, Stagecoach, and then as I got older, it became The Wild Bunch. I made my, even to The Ballad of Cable Hogue eventually. And then I also just sort of really dug like independent cinema. To me, it was just watching these movies like Pulp Fiction, and it was fantastic. James Mangold's early stuff, Heavy, even Copland. So those were the things I was dragging people to see in theaters. L.A. Confidential, I took people to see that. I went and saw it four times in theaters. I love that movie.
What is it sort of about the Western genre that you think appeals to so many sort of Americans in particular? Why is it such a special genre for you in particular?
I think, the genre itself has sort of become the American myth. It was what we created after the Civil War to try to heal this country. And that's why it's such a problematic myth. But it's become so ingrained in the American culture that it is sort of a shorthand for everything, from our politics to the way people communicate, to the way Americans see ourselves, at least a certain part of the country. To me, what's drawn me about it, what always drew me about to that genre, is the fact that it was such a, it was at this point where history and mythology meet, and it contains both all the flaws of what's wrong with our country and also a lot of the aspirate things we can aspire to be. And, you know, as a filmmaker, it's just it's such a cinematic genre. You know, the first, it's not a coincidence that, like, the first films were Westerns in America.
Like, you eventually sort of created your own production company, Sidetrack Films. How did that come into being? Did you sort of, was it enough, you were raising sort of money for all these other films? Did you decide, hey, I want to start doing that myself? Or was this always sort of a main goal for yourself to do this?
So I had always wanted to be on the creative side, and I ended up on the business side of it. And then it sort of became a, how am I going to get back to the creative side? And to be 100% honest, I wasn't brave enough to go and just be like, I'm going to go create movies. I'm going to write. I'm going to go direct. Like, I was not brave enough to do that. So having worked on the finance side, I had been talking to a couple different people, an investor, a guy, Robbie Ann, and then another man named Rich Lim, who had been working at a company called Film Movement that still exists in New York. And we decided to form Sidetrack to try to tell stories that weren't being told. And for me, it was sort of my way to start moving out of the finance side into the creative side, to learn how films are, you know, not just put together on a business, on paper, but how they're actually made.
When you sort of think of your original sort of side being involved in sort of the business, was there any films in particular that you were involved in that you think, oh, I'm really glad that I was able to raise the money for that film and to see that one come to life?
You know, I feel like it was more, I think the film that I was really excited to be involved with was like My Architect, which we helped sell and help that film get distribution. I was also, which was to me just so amazing to sort of be part of that early documentary boom that was starting in the early 2000s. And just see these creators, making films that were very, you know, at that point, like there weren't a huge theatrical doc market, and it, being part of that early place where it was taking off was truly wonderful. That's why I think I started producing documentaries at first, because it was such an exciting field to be in, and it still is.
How did you sort of pick the films that you wanted to get involved in producing?
You know, we looked, you know, with a lot of just sort of talking creatively. My partners had all, you know, I think everyone at the company had really good taste, and the way we decided to find projects were the ones that, spoke to us on a creative level that felt like there was a powerful storyteller behind it. A.J. Schnock, who did Kurt Cobain About a Son, is such a powerful director, and such, you know, he understood the documentary form so well. And he had such an interesting idea of how to approach this documentary where you hear Cobain and Kurt's voice narrate you through his life. We had a film called Lo and Behold, which was a hybrid narrative doc. That was the first film shot in New Orleans about Hurricane Katrina after that accident. And, you know, what I loved was the realism of the story and the way it merged fiction and nonfiction to bring the audience to an emotionally resonant place that really could understand the damage that's been caused there.
You mentioned sort of Kurt Cobain About a Son as one of the films you sort of produced. What attracted you to the story of Nirvana's Kurt Cobain?
You know, I to be honest, I'm a little young for the Kurt Cobain. Like, I was still like a little young when Nirvana hit the scene, and I remember them, but it wasn't to me an emotionally resonant. I don't have that emotional resonance from youth. But what was so interesting to me was seeing all these people who did. And I felt like, as someone who didn't know much about Kurt, I mean, I remember it, all the details of it, but to tell that story in a way that brought people like me in who weren't just relying on nostalgia, who were relying on wanting to learn more about this figure, learn who he is. What's so interesting about that movie is Kurt's voice is something people don't know. You know, people think of Kurt Cobain, they think of the way he sings, they think of the music, they have images of his head, but you actually have this very soft-spoken, eloquent man who's very thoughtful. So you have this very thoughtful, eloquent man whose voice is just not heard of very much. There weren't a lot of recordings. So to me, that was so interesting to sort of look behind this iconic figure and find the human being, which is something that always appeals to me in stories.
Was that sort of the same for sort of your Roger Corman documentary, Corman's World? Are you naturally attracted to sort of these documentaries and creating films about these creative talents that we all kind of look up to?
I'd say I'm more drawn to figures. I mean, I'm figures who have a very specific identity in our culture or in our world, and trying to, you know, add a three-dimensional nature to it, to find that human being there. I think, you know, it just so happened. I think my partners were really drawn to finding creative people. To me, I think it would be just I could probably be interested to do a documentary on a politician or something to find that human being behind them.
You moved on to writing and directing with Dead Man's Burden after that. And did you always want to make your own features? And how long had something like Dead Man's Burden been in your head and screaming to get out?
So I had been wanting to make my own features, and as I alluded to earlier, I was totally freaking terrified of doing that. And so I was in Sundance, and this was Sundance 2011, and I had Corman's World was premiering at Sundance, and I had a film at Slam Dance called Silver Tongues, which was this really twisted, dark little indie that ended up winning Slam Dance that year. And I was at that festival, and I was sitting in, I think I was watching Corman's World at one of the screenings, and everyone in that movie is talking about how, you know, Roger just gave them a chance. He just told them to go out and do it. Just go make something, you know, go make it. You know, you have an idea, just let's go make it and try to do it. And so I left that festival feeling very inspired, like, all right, I am going to actually do this. I need to just try to bite the bullet and scratch this itch and see if it goes somewhere. And I had no idea if it would. And so I knew I wasn't going to have a lot of money because I'd have to raise it. And I knew what the market was. And I knew Westerns don't play internationally very well. And you have to do, you know, you have to look at the domestic numbers. I guess I should say I knew it was going to be whatever the story I was going to tell, it was going to be a Western, because I always wanted to make a Western. And if, you know, sometimes, you know, when you make a movie, you can only make one movie in your life. I think it's very little self-centered to assume that if you make one movie, you're going to make a second. You might as well try to tell the story you want to tell. So, I've always had this idea of trying to explore the Civil War in America and how it, you know, look at how it broke the country through the lens of a family. So I sat down after Sundance and I wrote the script for Dead Man's Burden that spring, and through my financing connections, some of the old investors I'd worked with, some of the real people I'd worked with as a producer, I was able to put together, a budget for like a couple $200,000, I think it was less maybe at that point, and, actors. And we went and shot in New Mexico that fall in October.
It sounds like your producing background really helps with making movies like this. Was it when you made that sort of step up from producer to writer director, was it scary that first day on set, or did it feel like all your years, whether it been part of the film club, all the years producing your own production kind of org company, did it all lead to this?
No, it was terrifying. It was utterly terrifying. I felt in over my head. I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. I had confidence in my vision, but I'd never run a set as a director, and that was very different than being a producer. And I think that first day on the set, it was very hard for me because I was trying to, I kept thinking like a producer. I kept looking at the clock. I kept thinking about all those things. And I needed to be thinking about the creative. And I learned very quickly I had to turn that part of my brain off. I think during prep, all those skills were incredibly helpful in figuring out how we were going to shoot a Western on location, on film, in New Mexico, with horses and guns, and do it all in, 18 days.
what was the one moment for you when that moment clicked in your head, where you had moved from being a producer watching the clock to you're a director watching this all unfold? What was there one moment you thought, oh my God, I'm the director now, and you felt it?
It was interesting. The moment I actually really felt like a director was during our day before set shoot. It was like the day before, I really felt like it was going to be awesome, because the day before we started shooting, our last day of prep, I sat down with my actors and we read through the entire script and we were talking through it and creating how, turning these characters who were just on these sort of people on a page and bringing them to life together. And that aspect of it worked really well. On the other hand, we are, and then of course I stepped on set and it ended up feeling a little bit like, oh my God, step back. And then I remember, I think on the beginning of the second day, we're sitting down to do this very emotional scene with Barlow Jacobs and Claire Bowen, and, talking through, how we were going to use, sitting down with them for like 5 minutes and talking through how we were going to use the camera to understand the emotional stakes that was going on in this scene, because the movie is really about a brother and a sister who were reunited after the Civil War, who both have some terrible secrets. So I had the scene where we know their secrets, they don't know their secrets, and how we were going to block that and cover it in a way that was both would draw out the tension of the audience being ahead of the characters. I think that moment, and how the camera was going to do that, and how we were going to get the performances. And that there was sort of like, oh, this is how it comes together. This is how it all works. Okay, I don't have to worry about the clock. I don't have to worry about anything else. I just have to focus on, the scene we are creating right now.
You were saying Westerns are so hard to make and to get audiences for. When did you sort of realize that you could actually not just make one Western, but then follow that up with a second Western in the form of The Ballad of Lefty Brown? When did you sort of realize that there is an audience perhaps for this?
When I realized after we made Dead Man's Burden that, like, oh wow, if you make a Western, you're guaranteed to get into Walmart. Like, there's interest in Redbox. There's a Western channel. I remember when we were location scouting Dead Man's Burden, just driving around and seeing, like, and we'd go and we'd sit down with people in their house, or we'd sit down and go to a bar or something. Everywhere you went, there would be Westerns playing. They'd be either watching the Starz Western channel, or you'd go to a gas station and they'd have like two sections of, like, this was back when people were still really buying lots of movies. But there's like DVDs of like modern movies and DVDs of Westerns. So I realized there's this huge audience for it. And I didn't necessarily, when I sat down to make Lefty, knew I was going to do another Western. I'd been thinking about a couple things, but the character of Lefty had been one that had stayed with me for a long time. Cause he was really born out of, watching tons and tons and tons of Westerns. And so when it was time to make my next feature, I knew I had to tell his story.
I was curious when I first watched it, I always wonder what kind of came first. Was it sort of the character of Lefty Brown, or was it the story that this character might find himself in? What came first for you?
Well, for me, it came from watching all these old John Wayne Westerns, where you have, the Duke, this character who's John Wayne, and then he always has the sidekick, and he's either played by Andy Devine or Walter Brennan or, Gabby Hayes, and this guy who everyone laughs at, everyone makes fun of, he's the butt of every joke, yet he's also the person who John Wayne relies on at the most important moments. He's the one in Rio Bravo with Walter Brennan, in the jailhouse with the shotgun, the last line of defense, everything goes to shit. And to me, that was really interesting, the dichotomy of that character, who is this person that everyone makes fun of, yet the hero relies on. And so I wanted to tell that character's story, and I realized the only way I was going to tell that character's story was by getting rid of the hero.
I think that's one of my favorite parts of the movie, is like you go in, you're thinking like Ballad of Lefty Brown, of course he's going to be the hero character, it'll be that, and I love how that the movie pulls you kind of straight the rug out from you straight away. I think that was such a clever choice.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was what we wanted to do. We wanted to make it feel how the make the audience have the sense of the rug being pulled out of them, the same way Lefty felt that way.
How did you sort of cast the role of Lefty Brown and find Bill Pullman for the role?
So, Bill is someone I've always really admired as an actor. So when we were going out to try to figure out who could play Lefty, Bill was a dream to get. And I was like, I have no idea how I'm going to get Bill Pullman. We managed to get his agent, Hildy Gottlieb, who's married to Walter Hill. So she's a big Western fan. So we were able to get her the script, and she really loved it for Bill. We got it to Bill. And I remember sitting down with him. He liked it. I think he was shooting Independence Day 2 at the time. So it was like this glide period. And I remember sitting down for this first meeting, and it was set up through agents. So it was like a very awkward first meeting at like a cafe that neither of us had been to before, where you actually have to like wait and sort of, it's a tray service. So you wait and get your food and order, and you're trying to like have this conversation, like feel each other out and meet each other while you're like trying to figure out how to order, what you want to order, and a line of people are behind you. It became very clear as we were talking that we both had this great understanding of both the genre and who this character was. And the thing about Lefty as a character is it needs an actor who can take you all the way from someone who's, second fiddle, who's a beta, and try to make him into an alpha. And I think Bill has shown that over the course of his career. This is a guy who followed up Independence Day with Lost Highway.
Yeah, he's definitely one of Hollywood's most underrated actors, and I thought this was definitely one of his best performances. I thought you two made clearly a great pair in your script and his performance. It was a real collaboration there, it felt.
Yeah, it was. He was on board for about a little less than a year before we actually went into production, so that gave us the opportunity to really talk through, read through the script and talk through it and find a version that felt true to both of us. It wasn't about like rehearsing. It was like, all right, let's talk through the scenes. Let's talk through the dialogue. What are we thinking here? What are we not thinking here? And I trusted him to find his version of the character, which I think is really important. Trusting your actors to be able to do that.
I love the visual style of this film. You'd mentioned sort of your previous film and this one that you chose to shoot it on 35mm. What was sort of the creative thinking behind that, and what are sort of the pros and cons of going into the desert and shooting on film? You hear some of the horror stories over the years of how it's affected people, but what was it like for yourself?
I mean, for me, I knew I needed to shoot on film. We shot on 2x35, which gives you a natural widescreen look and the right amount of grain without getting the heroism of, like, which I think Anamorphic gives you. To me, it wasn't really a choice. I felt like for this genre, you had to shoot on film because I don't think Westerns tend to look... Well, most Westerns, when you watch them and they're shot digitally, there's a quality that's missing. You want to have it, the genre is so part of our brain that you want to have that, that grain and that depth that film gives you. It was risky. I mean, our dailies were, on Dead Man's Burden, our dailies were like a week behind. On Lefty, they were three behind, because you ship it from Montana and then, and then it flies to LA and then it gets over, and so that's one day, and then that night Photochem does the processing, and the next day our editor could pick up the drive with the processed film and he could upload it and cut some stuff, and so it was like 3 days later, and then it depended how good the internet was where we were.
You also mentioned sort of shooting in Montana. What was that sort of like? Was it a challenge or rewarding to be shooting in such challenging terrain?
Oh, it was totally worth it. It was totally worth it. It was Montana was a beautiful canvas to shoot a film on. We'd scouted a bunch of places, and we'd been looking we looked at Colorado, we looked at New Mexico, and then I went and scouted Montana. And Montana really is still the frontier untouched by civilization. And what it allows you is to get the camera and point it in four different directions and have amazing vistas and shots that give you that sort of scope of a landscape that you can juxtapose with what is essentially an intimate story that period, an intimate coming-of-age story.
When you're sort of in a place like Montana and shooting this frontier, is it moments like that when you think back to being that film fan, watching Westerns in film club, and, you know, being a lover of the genre, where it's like, wow, like, you're almost living sort of your younger self's dream in a way?
Oh, totally. There is this amazing, you're like out here in the middle of nowhere on the frontier, you know, making a Western the way people made Westerns, you know, 100 years ago. Yeah. And it was, and it's really living a Western when you're making a Western, because you start realizing like, oh, you are totally at the mercy of the West, of the weather, of, you know, the horses, of whatever animals are there. It is like, oh, I'm in this and I'm living this. And I'm taking a four-wheeler up a hill and it might just suddenly start snowing and we'll just deal with it.
The film premiered at South by Southwest, and it was shortly bought up by sort of A24. What's it like when you hear someone like A24 with such a positive reputation and an excellent filmography is keen to add your film to their catalogue?
It was really exciting. They had released a Western I was a big fan of called Slow West.
Yeah, I love that one too.
Which is fantastic. You know, such a European twist of the genre. So good. And so I was really excited when they came on board because, you know, sometimes I think the thing about a Western is, you know, they're not enough made that necessarily every distributor knows what to do with it. And I love those guys at A24. I've known them since I was a sales agent. Multiple lifetimes ago for all of us. And it was so cool to just have that they wanted us to be part of their brand.
What is their reputation like amongst, say, filmmakers and as you mentioned, sort of sales agents, that we have this vision of them from the outside that they do everything this way, that way, that they're so wonderful. What's it like when you're sort of within the industry as opposed to the outside and a film fan, perhaps?
Well, what's really interesting, I think, about the way A24 does things is that most distributors work in a way where they have release plans. They have like two or three just sort of standard release plans. So that we're gonna platform it. We're gonna go wide. We're gonna, you know, do, like, they have sort of two or three options. And what they do is they take your film and they look at it and go, okay, which of our two to three plans does this fit into? They sort of shoehorn your film into it. What A24, I think, does, which is really interesting, is they look at the film and go, what is the best way to release this film? Instead of trying to force the film into one of our sort of prearranged plans, let's think about this film, let's think about what we have, and let's think about how we can best get the exposure off of it.
What's that like with that sort of thing? Do they involve the filmmakers, or do they go, right, we're going to take this and we'll kind of do the distribution and release? Do you get much involvement at that stage, or how does that work?
No, they're very collaborative in talking to you and keeping you in the loop and trying to work through it with you. I mean, you know, it's a distributor, so at the end of the day, they generally have control over a lot of things, but they did their best to keep the filmmakers happy, which, you know, is something that not every distributor does.
I'm curious as well, like, you touched on it, like Slow West, a film that we both clearly love, that A24 released maybe about 90 odd films, but there's only three out and out Westerns in that: The Ballad of Lefty Brown, Slow West, and Mojave. What is it about your film where you're talking about that loads of Westerns are made a year, enough to fill TV channels? What is it that you think that they saw in The Ballad of Lefty Brown that they went, that's a film for us, that fits in with what we're looking to create with our filmography?
To me, I think what they understand about the Western is that you have to appeal to the classical, you have to both appeal to the classical fans of the genre. You can't do something that's going to really, well, you, because that's where the money is, that's where the audience is, but you also have to do something that takes the classical vibe and, you know, tweaks it and does something interesting with it. You know, I mean, you know, for us, we took these characters, for me and Lefty, it was, all right, let's take these archetypes, you know, the John Wayne character, the Walter Brennan character, you know, the drunk sheriff, the, you know, law, by, you know, the young, the, you know, lawyer type, you know, who doesn't like using guns, like, and try to find the human being behind those characters. and add this very sort of cool European twist to it, and a European sensibility. But they didn't know. But they're both films, I would say, in a way, obvious as well, that are that appeal to the classical, the audience, that understand that appeal to the classical audience, but also are smart enough to figure out how to move the genre forward.
What was it like with the film when it came, got released? It came in sort of the final quarter of 2017, alongside sort of that final stretch of the year with The Killing of the Sacred Deer, Lady Bird, and The Disaster Artist. What's it like when you're in amongst those sorts of high quality films as well? Do you think, is it sort of exciting to be sort of that end of year fare, or do you think, is there a worry that you'll think, oh, The Ballad of Lefty Brown might get overlooked amongst all these films that are out there sort of competing for people's attention over sort of Christmas periods and Oscar times?
You can't really. You have to just sort of go with what their plan is and trust in their plan. And maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. And, you know, that's, as a filmmaker, you know, when you're working with a distributor, they're going to put the film out in the way they feel like it's the best way to put the film out. So yeah, I mean, I think you're excited because of who you're up against, but you're also terrified. You know, it's a plus and minus. It's both a positive experience and a negative one.
What was sort of the reaction amongst, like, I'm not much of a Western viewer myself, but what was it amongst those ones that the people that you were saying that watch those Stars Western channels that go to the Western bar?
Oh,
what did they
it.
Think of this
it,
film?
They really love it. We got a lot of love from like the Cowboys and Indians fans of the world. That's that, you know, big Western magazine. You know, it's been, you know, we played lot, you know, we did festivals and theaters, and, you know, people watched it now on like DirecTV and Amazon Prime now, and it's huge in that world. People really love it. Western fans will like come out of the woodwork to tell me how much they love it. Much, you know, it's a different audience. It's not Hollywood, but the response in that audience has been really fantastic, and it's very exciting.
Is it exciting now as a filmmaker that for years, sort of, if you make a film, it would maybe end up on that DVD market or you would see it on TV? Now with things like Amazon Prime, iTunes USA, DirecTV, your film can be accessed at any time of the day, any moment. What's that like for you as a filmmaker at this kind of time of your life, that when you think of sort of when being grown up as a film fan and now you've got this moment where like anyone in the world can watch your film at the click of a few buttons?
I mean, it's exciting in that, like, you know, I made a film that, you know, appeals to people who live in very rural locations, who live in, you know, small towns where there's not movies, you know, they're not art house theaters, where there's not really video stores, that they can now watch it. You know, it makes it so much more accessible to people, which is really, really wonderful. You know, and having the A24 brand behind it to me is also really important because it helps it stand out from the noise. Because, you know, the scary thing about the fact that so everything is available at a click of a button is that everything is available at a click of a button. And you know, that's just very overwhelming for people because they're like, what do I choose? So having an audience, having some, you know, tastemaker like a distributor like A24 on putting their name on it helps, I think, elevate it in that, you know, so people are aware of it, can find it, can see it.
Do you think that brings like a different audience sometimes to your film, not just the Western fans, but maybe it's someone that watches a Lady Bird and goes, I'm going to check out their other films. Okay, I'm going to check out this Lefty Brown, or someone that loves Spring Breakers or, you know, Bling Ring, whatever. And they go, right, what's the next one? I'm going to pick this one. Do you find that a different audience has maybe found this movie at times?
100%. Yeah, I think so. I think there's been, and what was really interesting is that women really respond to the movie. And I think, you know, having, you know, people who come from, you know, that age, you know, having that art house cred on it, like, you know, the people who love Lady Bird might want to check it out, and then they'll discover that they responded. Because I think the thing about Westerns is people have a lot of predisposed opinions about them, a lot of them negative. I don't like Westerns. I don't want to watch a Western. I don't like it. You know, so one of the hardest things is just getting people to try it. And that was very successful. That having A24 behind us with those other types of films, I think made it appeal to, you know, made people look past that bias against the genre.
Is there any sort of A24 films or filmmakers that you have a personal preference for, or you think that's the film that I love the most from them?
I don't know, Spring Breakers is pretty amazing. It's pretty awesome. But I also love, like, Moonlight, Flow West. I don't like to say, like, there's one film when, you know, when you have a distributor that has so many great titles, too, that there's one film that spoke to me the most. I think there's a lot of films on there that are really interesting and really emotional and really beautiful. And to, like, say, okay, one person is an inspiration or is a, you know, I feel like it sort of disservice to everyone else.
Absolutely. And what is it sort of you're working on at the moment? What's been following the success of the Ballad of Lefty Brown? What are you making? Are you going for a third Western in a row, or is it something else you're going
to do? I have a third Western that is not going to be made yet, but I have talked to A24 about it. But no, I'm working on a science fiction, actually, like a modern science fiction sort of project with J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot and Paramount.
Oh, wow.
And that has been the thing I've been working on the most. And then I'm also talking with Bill Pullman about doing another film together.
What's it like working with sort of like, I'm a huge Star Trek fan personally as well. What's it like working with there we go. I'm sure we could do a second podcast on Star Trek. What's it like to be involved with J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot? They're producing some of the most exciting big movies and investing in so many great smaller films as well. What's your experience been like with Bad Robot, and when can we maybe see sort of the fruits of that work?
The experience has been fantastic. I mean, they are such smart, creative, executive people over there. They both understand sort of the commercial nature of what they need to achieve in the world they're in, but are very character based, very story based, and really understand, you know, how to keep a, you know, creator happy. It's been a really nice collaboration so far, and hopefully we'll start trying to put it together next year.
And what kind of, from going from Westerns to sci-fi, has it been a challenge or a change for you, or has it been something that, again, it's just a natural progression for yourself?
I mean, it has been a challenge to some degree, in that, you know, I think in a Western, the scope of the world is something I really like to play with, to juxtapose, you know, this vast land and these intimate stories. And I think, you know, this is a very sort of grounded sci-fi set in the neighborhoods you don't drive, that, you know, people commute through when they're in LA, and trying to figure out how to use the world in the same way I use the world in a Western, or how to even not use the world, you know, make claustrophobic spaces, have that same, use the language of a claustrophobic space the way I use the language of a, you know, wide, vast frontier horizon, has been, I think, the hardest part to me. At the end of the day, you know, I think my films are all about the characters, so moving characters from one world, you know, in a Western world versus doing characters in a sci-fi world, they're still people.
I'm sort of reminded of Gene Roddenberry's quote about Star Trek, that it was the wagon train to the stars, that Westerns was what he grew up on, and he made Star Trek. That it maybe is that natural progression for so many filmmakers like yourself and talents like Gene Roddenberry to go from Westerns to sci-fi. It seems that there's definitely been that road has been traveled.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yes. I mean, look, Firefly, right?
Yeah.
Firefly was originally, Joss Whedon pitched it as a Western, and no one would buy it as a Western, so they turned it into a sci-fi story. You know? If you watch the opening of Firefly, it's the same thing. You see, like, oh, there was a civil war, and this is a group of rebels. And you're like, oh, yeah, I see how this was a Western. It was a sin, instead of, you know, there's even horses and cowboys in the opening. It's, like, crazy.
If you were to maybe recommend, like, a Western or two that maybe that people might not have seen or heard of, that maybe they've listened to this and, you know, you're one of the few Westerns they've seen because of, say, A24 or something like that, what would you recommend kind of finally for people to check out?
I'm going to name a couple. I would say for people who like off the beaten path westerns that are a little more lyrical and beautiful, I would say The Ballad of Cable Hogue, which is the film Sam Peckinpah made after The Wild Bunch, which is the story of Jason Robards, plays a man who's left for dead in the desert and finds water where it's never supposed to be. He creates a waste, forms a way, he builds a little way station where he, and he waits for a chance to get revenge. But it is this lovely, lyrical, almost musical Western that is really beautiful. I would also say watching the Anthony Mann Westerns are fantastic, like with Jimmy Stewart, The Naked Spur, Winchester 73, or The Man from Laramie. They're these really almost gritty Westerns about that have a strong psychological edge. With variations of character, these obsessive characters who are very modern, yet moving through a world that is very classical.
I will definitely be checking those out. But if people wanted to maybe sort of follow your career or upcoming kind of projects online, is there any sort of websites or Twitter handles you'd recommend people maybe follow?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. You know, you might get some, you'll get what movies I'm into, movies I'm watching, stuff I'm working on, and the occasional sports references. You know, it's at Jared Moshe on Twitter. I also have a website, jaredmoshe.com, but Twitter is usually the best way to follow me.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Jared. It's been really exciting to learn about your career to date, and I think you've left me and everyone else really excited for what's to come for you, for potentially another A24 film, something with Bad Robot. That's a career that I'm excited to follow.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for talking to me. It's been really exciting, and hopefully we'll get you to talk again.